Hello and happy Easter to everybody. This is season 2, episode 9 of Roped In. I'm your host, John Roper. I've got a pretty fun one ahead of us. Where I say it was fun, it was just fun for me because it was a kind of research heavy episode. But no, two of these segments are just ones that I didn't know much about before going into it. One of them I'd seen briefly, and the other one I didn't know about until today. I was chatting with my sister, Christine, and she mentioned a name, and I did some research, and now I want to talk about him. So our segments today. First off, we've got the obscure sports, another reoccurring segment, and on today's episode, I've got the sport of hurling. Then in the second segment is where my sister Christine gave me the inspiration. It's a new segment called Heroes in Sports. And today's Heroes in Sports is Jacob Wasserman. If you don't know the name, stick tuned to find out. Finally, I'm going to be talking about March Madness. So I've talked about it in the past couple of episodes, but now we've gotten a lot of games under our belt through March Madness. We've only got about, three, four more games to go. So I'm going to be talking about that, wrapping that up. And yeah, there you have it. So again, obscure sports, hurling, heroes in sports, Jacob Wasserman, and then a little bit of the March Madness roundup. As always, sit back, relax, and let's get right into it. So we've got a reoccurring segment, a returning segment on the Roped In podcast. It's obscure sports. And on today's segment of the obscure sports, it is the sport of hurling. So hurling is a Gaelic Irish sport. And if you're wondering what it is, it's a combination of kind of like hockey, baseball, soccer. So soccer in terms of the equipment, it's more of a hockey baseball kind of equivalent. It's kind of weird. Either way, it's got iterations and stuff that go as far back, kind of different versions of the game have been played as far back as 1200 BCE. So it's a game that's stuck around for a long time. And when I explain the rules, you'll understand why, because it's a game that didn't require a crazy amount. So again, it's gone as far back, but in 1879 is when the Irish Hurling Union was founded. In 1884, the Gaelic Athletic Association was created, and then the two kind of got together, and in 1888, the official written rules of hurling were created. I'm sure it's changed a little bit since 1888, but that basically is usually when I say when a sport has started is when that kind of first official rule book, the first official written rules of the sport, that's when I kind of call it, that's when the sport started. So in 1888, hurling started. It's an amazing sport. And again, it was really started over in Ireland. A lot of countries in the United Kingdom have kind of taken it over. You've got Scotland, both of the Irish countries, Wales, England, they all play this sport. Other countries that now play it, though, you've got Australia and South Africa. So it kind of makes sense with those kind of countries with the Queen and everything. Argentina and North American countries are also playing it. So those are the countries. I'm sure it's played other places, but those are the countries that kind of have national teams and compete on the world level. They're the ones that really recognize hurling as a sport. So now let me explain what hurling is. So hurling is played on a rectangular field. It's about 130 to 145 meters by around 80 to 90 meters is the size of this thing. So it's bigger than a rugby pitch. It's absolutely massive, which if you ever watch highlights and you hear the rules, it makes sense because of how it's played, but it is a huge pitch. Again, it's a huge rectangle and it's got a goal on either end. So it's got a goal standing in the middle like it's a soccer goal. It's got a 21-foot width and it's just right there in the middle of the baseline. How the goal looks, though, is quite different. So it reminded me quite a bit of like high school stadiums or just like recreational parks that want to take advantage of everything. It's basically a soccer goal with a football field goal above it. So you've got the regular soccer net, well, maybe not regular, but the soccer net that's 21 feet apart. And then sticking up from either corner are the poles that go straight up like a field goal or like a rugby pitch or like those AFL poles that stick up. Basically, two poles right in the air. So yeah, that's the field, that's the goal, the teams. So there's 15 people per team, which means there's 30 people on the field at all times. How the team consists, you've got one goalkeeper, you've got three fullbacks, so your back line, three halfbacks that are kind of theoretically standing in front of your fullbacks, you've got two midfielders that are doing it all, you've got three half forwards that I kind of think of as attacking midfielders, and then you've got three full forwards. So the way I break it in my head as a soccer person, one goalkeeper, three defenders, three defensive mids, two mids, three attacking mids, and three forwards. So there's 15 people per team. You wear cleats. The helmet you have out there, I find, is very similar to a junior hockey helmet. So it's got that plastic kind of bucket, but it's got the metal cage that kind of comes down. Now, it doesn't have as many grids as a junior hockey helmet, but it's that metal cage that comes down. It's got the chin strap. It just buckles under there. Your jersey looks like it's a soccer jersey. Your bat, this is where I'm going to say it's like baseball. I think it's called a hurl. Looks like an oar. It's just a wooden paddle with a bigger surface area at the very end of it. So it kind of does look like a mini oar in a way, but like a sports oar, like a paddle. And then you've got the ball. That's basically all it consists of. Every player has the same kind of equipment. I do believe the goalie has extra padding, and his hurl is of a different design. But there you have it. They're kind of going out there. I don't know a lot of the strategy, so I can't say I can break it down there. It's 60-minute matches, two halves, so it's 30-minute halves, 60-minute matches. And basically, you get 3 points if you get it in the football goal. The soccer goal. So get it into like the net part of the goal. And then it's 1 point if you hit it over, but between the two poles. So basically, if you score what's a football goal, it's going to be 3 points. If you score an American football goal, which is a field goal, it's 1 point. You can hit the ball from anywhere to try and score. Obviously, you're not going to try and score on the goalkeeper from a crazy distance away. But when you watch highlights, I mean, people are 3/4 of the way down the field just wanting a point, and they just whack the living Jesus out of it through those two poles. Now, some might say, oh, what's the challenge? Why not just constantly hit it that hard? I don't know if you've ever tried to hit something and really hit it with that accuracy and that power. It's not as easy to just snipe it between the two poles every single time. Yes, you can get it a decent amount of times. When you have defenders running around you, it's not going to be that easy. So it's more challenging than you would think. But that's the scoring structure, how it really breaks down. There are timeouts in this, substitutions that go on. But I don't know strategy to really break down when those are in play and how many and when players take them. How the game is played is the ball is really swatted in the air. Kind of like if you're in your backyard just playing some baseball, wanting to hit a ball into a net or something like that. You throw the ball up in the air and you hit it. That's basically you hit it to your teammates or you try and hit it into the goal. And you're basically just trying to go forward. And when you're on defense, you're trying to stop the team from going forward. It's pretty simple, pretty straightforward. You can catch the ball. That is one of the things. So it's not like lacrosse where you have to use the oar only. When the ball's coming your way, you can catch it, and then you've got to throw it in the air and hit it again. So I'm going to explain what are fouls, which might help explain how the game is played in terms of the structure and, again, just overall gameplay. So one of the fouls is you can't just pick the ball up with your hands. If you're getting the ball from the ground, you've got to scoop it up with the paddle, with the hurl. That's kind of like lacrosse. So you've got to scoop it up with the hurl. You cannot throw the ball with your hand. You've got to... This one is where it's like American rules football. That's a throwback to one of my earlier season one episodes. One of the first obscure sports segments, actually. I can't fully remember which episode it was. I could try and track it down, but that might get a little bit tricky. But it's one where you can't pass the ball with your hands. You've got to use the equipment around you. You've got to actually hit the ball. So that's where you pass the ball to your teammate. That's how you score. You cannot take more than 4 steps with the ball in your hand. So how I said, you can catch it. You can't just run and then when you're like, I don't want the ball anymore, have to hit it. You cannot take more than 4 steps. So again, it's very similar to American rules football where you've got to bounce the ball before. So you cannot take more than 4 steps without hitting the ball. You also cannot catch the ball 3 times in a row without it hitting the ground. This one I don't know too much about, but again, if you pass the ball to your teammate and you're constantly passing it together, one of those actually has to be a pass. So I'm sure people have perfected a bounce pass where you swat it straight into the ground to get to your teammate, or just a deep pass where you're about to catch it, you shield off the teammate, kind of like you're boxing out, wait for it to bounce, and then you catch it. You shield off your opponent, sorry. So you can't catch it 3 times in a row without it bouncing. So it has to bounce on the ground. You cannot switch hands with the ball. So if you're running and you take 1 step, you can't switch it to the other hand and then take your other 2 steps before hitting it. It's got to stay in the hand you catch it in. You cannot lie down on the ball to block it. And you cannot throw it up in the air and then catch it again. You can if it bounces off somebody or deflects it or something weird, then yes, you can catch it again without swinging. But you can't throw it up in the air, change your mind, and catch it again. That's a no-no. So I hope that kind of explains how it's played by saying what you can't do. Because I find that's a lot easier explaining what you can't do to say what you can. Hard penalties. So what I call are cards. If you pull someone to the ground, if you use your paddle as a weapon, or if you trip somebody, and then also physical violence, of course. You can't punch somebody, you can't spin on somebody, you can't hit somebody with a hurl, you can't throw the hurl at somebody. So those are the cardable offenses. How you can tackle in this. So tackling is kind of how you would think it would be based off what I've explained and if you watch highlights. So you could tackle by if somebody hits it, you just basically block it, and then you pick it up with your hurl and you go again. If somebody throws it up in the air, you can quickly swipe it out of the air with your hurl. I don't believe you could just quickly catch it, but you can swipe it out of the air with your hurl. When the ball is on the ground and 2 people are running towards it, obviously you can swipe the ball with your hurl, to get it towards the direction that you're going in to give you the better advantage and then scoop it up with your hurl from there. And then finally, you can do a shoulder nudge. So if 2 people are kind of running towards the ball, and you make that shoulder contact, shoulder nudging. So basically the hit stick, but the 2 of you have to hit stick each other. It has to be a shoulder to shoulder contact, and you can knock the person to the ground and then go for the ball. So yeah, that's how it's played. I don't know a crazy amount about it, but in the highlights that I've watched, it is a very intense game. It looks pretty dangerous. It looks like there's a decent amount of injuries that can happen from it, but it also just looks like a world of fun. So, I mean, there you have it. There's my obscure sport in hurling. It's the Gaelic Irish sport. I hope you pick it up. If you don't, I hope you at least give it a highlight watch. It is really entertaining. But either way, the Irish people, they've got some pretty crazy sports out there, and hurling for sure is one of them. And now we're moving on to a new segment that is going to be a reoccurring segment. So again, this was kind of triggered and lit a light bulb in my head by my sister, Christine Roper. Shout out, I've got to get her on an episode one day. So if you're listening to this, I promise I'm going to get you on an episode. For those that don't know, she is an Olympic gold medalist rower. She's an absolute badass. But she mentioned a certain athlete that made the Canadian Paralympic team. And it made me do some research and be like, yo, this guy actually is a hero. And now I'm going to create a new segment in Roped In. Heroes in sports. Now, I'm not going to say it's going to be a crazy long segment. Each segment's going to be different based on the person of what they've gone through. But because my sister triggered the idea, I'm going to talk about the athlete she triggered it with. And he, from the intro, if you remember, his name is Jacob Wasserman. So some people might right away know the name Jacob Wasserman, especially Canadians. Some people probably don't. But when I say one thing, I think a lot of people are going to know right away where his story is from. So Jacob Wasserman was part of the Humboldt Lions hockey team, the junior hockey team here in Canada. Now, if that hasn't lit the light bulb, I will say the story. So in April 2018, they might not be the Lions, but the Humboldt hockey team had a fatal car accident, unfortunately. So a truck driver ran a stop sign, hit the bus, and it killed 16 people and had 13 survivors. So of the 16 were the bus driver, team people, in terms of coaches, medical staff, and I think it was 13 or maybe it was 12 other athletes. Not that it makes the story any different, but it was a junior hockey team, so these athletes were younger. Jacob Wasserman was among the 13 survivors. He was the goalkeeper, goaltender of this team. He was left paralyzed from the legs down. He also got a brain injury, two collapsed lungs, a broken shoulder blade, a fractured ribs, a nasal bone fracture, and was induced in a coma. So it was obviously scary times right away from that accident. It took a lot of the Canadian sports world by storm, and I think just North American sports world. It was obviously sad when anything like that happens, but sports took it being the platform of a sports team, especially a youth sports team, and took advantage of it. Well, no, I shouldn't say took advantage. That's definitely the wrong word, but they showcased it, and they, I don't know why I say took advantage. That's definitely the wrong word. That's nowhere near what I meant to say, but they were showcasing this, because it was a huge story in its industry. And Jacob Wasserman, one of the survivors, never stopped playing sports. So he always had that edge. He always wanted to compete in sports. He did have a brief career in sledge hockey, but you know, it didn't work out for him. He said it didn't feel right. I don't think you can go from the physical sport that you played with the teammates that you lost to the Paralympic version of it. I think you're too used to playing a certain way that if you try to learn it a different way, you're just going to get frustrated that it's not working for you. But he didn't lose a competitive edge, and he kind of flipped his sights over to the water. So in 2019, he actually competed for Canada in the World Championships for Adaptive Water Skiing. I didn't also know what that was if you don't. They use a kind of adapted wakeboard, a makeshift wakeboard. That's how they do it. And Jacob Wasserman was great at it, and he competed with Canada in a 2019 World Championship. That's, I guess, where his intro to the world of Paralympic or sports with a disability, I guess is maybe the right term to put for it. But he kept his world in the water sports with people for disability. And in 2022, in October 2022, he ran into a Paralympic rower in a grocery store. And they kind of got to chatting and everything. I don't fully know the story, but he tried out some rowing. He tried out the I'm going to say Paralympic rowing. He tried out that form of rowing. It was in a skull. So it's for rowers that cannot use their bottom half. So again, he was paralyzed from the waist down. You get strapped into a kind of seat, a strap around your waist to keep you uptight. And you're basically just doing your upper body and kind of leaning forward and everything. And it's all upper body, but similar from there. Which, I mean, I am a rower, and a lot of where power comes from is in your legs. I could only imagine the physical strength and the toll it would take to use upper body only. But Jacob Wasserman did it, and he just recently competed in a regatta down in Rio de Janeiro for Canada. He's really gotten pretty good. Actually, I was saying for Canada, but he kind of competed down there representing Canada, and he came second. And based off his time and everything, he's actually secured a spot for the Paralympic Games in Paris, France, this summer from August 28th to September 8th in the men's sculling. So it is absolutely amazing to see Jacob Wasserman. You are, without a doubt, an amazing story. I mean, the story right away was something inspirational to see what you were doing beforehand, but to have gone through everything you're going through and not let that define you and not let that stop you. Again, you have defined. You are, without a doubt, a hero in sports. And wrapping up today's episode, we're going to be doing another recap of the March Madness. I've done it in the past few episodes, but it's because it's still going on, and it's an exciting tournament. It's something that's captivated my world, so I'm going to be talking about it. I did mention, you know, some stories that happened last weekend through the first round, but I'm going to do a recap so far of what has happened. You know, takeaways right away, UConn and Purdue look tough. They look like the top teams in the country. They look like they deserve their number one seed. Not that Houston and UNC didn't. Spoiler, UNC and Houston are already out, but Houston looks a little bit better. But UConn and Purdue have looked every bit the best teams, and UConn has looked every bit the best team in the country that they were going into this. They are a unstoppable force. But let's bring it all the way back, you know, starting with the first round. So first round of this men's March Madness was usual madness. I mean, it was absolutely crazy. There was 11 upsets in that first round. For those that don't know, it's 32 games. 11 upsets. Is it 32? Yeah, it's 32 games because there's 64 teams that are in it. So it was fun to see that 11 upsets happen. Three of the 11 upsets were the 9 seeds. So that 8 versus 9 matchup, three of the 9 seeds ended up winning. Two 12 seeds. I thought that Yale was the lowest of the seeds to pull an upset, but no. Oakland University over the University of Kentucky, the 14 seed over the 3 seed, was the team that was the lowest seed to win. It was fun to watch. Kentucky is a powerhouse of a program. Oakland was not, so that was a huge story to kind of see happen. Yale, again, being the Ivy League team, I didn't predict it, but I should have. You know, Ivy League teams are always sneaky. They always come out with that edge, usually because they have the four-year players that know how to play in their system together. They play really well, and they cause those upsets because people don't predict them to do crazy things. They had a win. So, you know, those were really fun things to see. On Oakland side, I've talked about him already. Jack Golkey, I think, took the nation by storm for a week and a bit. He absolutely impresses with threes. He's the guy that had 327 threes versus 8 two-point attempts this season. So, super, super fun to watch that kind of thing happen. Some names that kind of... Actually, let me not get into names. Those were kind of it. I'm not going to get into every single breakdown. Another really, really exciting thing that happened in the opening round was Dayton. So Dayton versus Nevada. Dayton 7 seed, Nevada 10 seed. Nevada looked like they were going to be pulling the upset. They had a 17-point lead with 7 minutes to go, and then Dayton pulled off the 5th biggest comeback in March Madness history to end up winning that match. I predicted Dayton to win. I would not have predicted Dayton to have that much of a comeback. So that was super, super fun to watch. Absolutely amazing. Other crazy things happened. But I can't get into every single story. Moving on to the second round is where a little bit of normality came into it. In terms of, you know, some of the favorites. Or not some. Most of the favorites ended up winning that one. I think Clemson, that round, to me, was the only, you know, shocker of a team to end up winning there. NC State surprised people that they're that far, but it's because they went against Oakland, who just surprised Kentucky. So if NC State went up against Kentucky, would they have won? I mean, they're on a magical run now. Currently, they're beating Duke as I'm recording this, so who's to say they wouldn't have, you know? But NC State and Clemson going this far, I think, were the two surprises out of the second round. Everything else, you know, some upsets happened, but I think it was the upsets that people thought were going to happen. I mean, second round, again, nothing really crazy happened. I've said it a million times. Then we're moving on to the Sweet 16, and we've got some big lines again. So, starting it off on the brackets that I'm going into was UNC losing. So, UNC was a one seed. RJ Davis, Armando Bacot, who seems like he's been in the NCAA for about like 20 years now. He's had his whole career in NCAA, but they're a really, really good team. Harrison Ingram, and Alabama comes through and beats them. Now, Alabama is also a good basketball team. I don't want to knock on Alabama, but UNC is a powerhouse of a basketball program, and Alabama should not have been able to beat them, but they did. Clemson winning again, that was another big one. Clemson beat Arizona. So Arizona, I don't think, was a dominant team that I had going overly far, but I definitely didn't see Clemson doing this. So Clemson having shocked last round, and then they shock again this round. It was fun to see. NC State was continuing to roll. I mean, as an 11 seed, they rolled by the 2 seed Marquette. So they're continuing their magical run. They kept it going in the Sweet 16. Duke was another upset. Now, Duke is a powerhouse program, but this year They were a 4 seed heading into the tournament, and Houston was the 1 seed. Houston's got some really, really good players. I like Shed on his team or on that team. But Houston could not pull it off. Duke ended up upsetting them in the Sweet 16. I think everything else happened the way it was supposed to, don't get me wrong, but that's where it was really, really crazy to see those kind of matchups there. Then we kind of move on in Elite Eight. So Elite Eight, UConn just continues to absolutely steamroll. I think there was a stat where it's 13 games in a row since March Madness lost last year that UConn had. They've won double-digit runs in, like, games that matter. They won by double digits. I mean, they've won by 20-plus every game this tournament. If they tried to actually play out the rest of the ones, they probably would have won by 35 to 40-plus. They just locked it down early on. But in the again, I don't want to harp on that because I'm going to get on to UConn. But Alabama with Sears, their top scorer, he keeps scoring for them, and Alabama was the one that ended up knocking out Clemson. So they've moved on to the Final Four. It's going to be UConn versus Alabama. And then today, which is March 31st, Tennessee played Purdue. Now, in my bracket, this is where I had Purdue losing. I'm going to be honest, I didn't do a lot of research. It was because Purdue had an ugly exit last year. Now, I should have thought they would have had a chip on their shoulder, but Tennessee's who I went with because I really, really like Dalton Connect. So I predicted Tennessee. So going into this matchup, I wanted Tennessee to win. Now, Tennessee came out hot, and Tennessee came out defending pretty well. Don't get me wrong, Zach Edey was doing his thing. He was an absolute beast on the boards. But they were defending well, and Tennessee kind of had a decent lead at one point. But then Purdue just became Purdue, and Tennessee could not keep up with Zach Edey. They got in foul trouble. They got tired down low. Tennessee kind of gave it up a little bit. Now, they fought. They continued to fight, and they did not just give up. This is where I think the difference between UConn and Purdue is UConn has steamrolled every competition. Now, I also think that it's the tough competition. I don't think San Diego State is the competition that Tennessee probably was. So I don't think UConn's faced the same challenge Purdue did. But this was the first time that Purdue looked beatable. Now, Zach Edey is a dominant force, and they had their way. But you can't tell me after watching that match that you're convinced that they're going to go all the way. Because if they go up against... if they had what they just had against Tennessee, but now they're going to go up against UConn, who's this powerhouse of a franchise, of a team. Yeah, I think that's got Purdue shaking in their boots a little bit. But at the end of the day, watching Zach Edey put up a 40-point performance, absolutely amazing. That's got to scare every other team out there because there's no matchup to Zach Edey. I love Donovan Klingon on UConn. I've mentioned him a few times, but Zach Edey is just... There's no big man. The last big man like him in the NBA, in the NCAA, was Greg Oden. Now, Greg Oden had his injury problems, but Greg Oden could have been the next great big man. And I don't want to say Zach Edey can be the next great big man, but he just dominates. Now, when he goes up against the NBA, he's going to be going up against men his size, and it's going to be different. But spoiler alert for an episode where I'm going to be doing a mock draft, I want Miami Heat to be drafting Zach Edey. They need big man help, and he is the biggest of the men. So... again, Purdue ended up winning. Now we've got Duke and NC State in the last of the Elite Eight matchups. Duke, I thought, not was going to steamroll, but just with their experience of the organization, that they were going to have a pretty good, you know, double-digit match against NC State, and this is where NC State was going to stop. But, I mean, I'm watching this right now as we're recording, and NC State and that DJ Burns, again, DJ Burns is the body of Hakeem, a body of Zach Randolph, but wants to play like Hakeem. He's absolutely amazing, but he's not the only one. DJ Horn on their team. You know, they've got some really, really, really good players. And Duke no longer has their coach. They're a big one-and-done franchise. So say they have a lot of kind of history and experience being here. This current team probably doesn't. They're an entire different roster, an entire different head coach. You know, they're not used to this situation, I don't think. So right now, NC State is beating Duke. Now, Duke can come back. When you listen to this, the game's going to be over, so who's to know what's going to happen? I predicted Duke, so I want Duke to go on. But, again, I love the story of NC State, so I'm going to be happy either way. Seeing NC State make it this far has been absolutely amazing. So now some of the names that I really like to watch. Now, I'm really only going to be getting into two or three of them.
So one of the fun names that I really got through that, again, is a guy. Now, where I'm going to backtrack, these names that I'm watching, I'm going to be honest, are names that I thought Miami Heat had the ability to draft later on in the draft. So those are the names that I wanted to watch. But the one that stood out to me was Tyler Kolek on Marquette. I had no idea who he was before going into this. And he, I think, was leading the league in leading the NCAA in assists, he might have been. But he was having a great tournament with Marquette. Really, really good player. Again, DJ Burns is my absolute favorite player this tournament for NC State. Playing right now, having a great game. He's been having a great tournament. But I think Zach Edey has been, without a doubt, the MVP of this March Madness for Purdue. He's just a 20-10 machine. He might even be a 30-10 machine right now when you look at it. Again, 40 points today. He had a 30-point, 21-rebound opening round. Him and Braden Smith are just a magic at them. Now, Braden Smith is tiny, so it's really funny to watch a really small point guard and a huge center. But they just create magic, and the rest of the team around them, when they play their role well, Purdue's a really, really good team. Now, on UConn, there's nobody that I'm watching. So I mentioned Donovan Klingon a few times, but Tristan Newton is also a very, very, very good player. And their point guard, I want to say his last name is Spencer, but he's going to go early in the draft. He's very, very good as well. But Newton and Klingon are the two in my eyes that are the best, the kind of two that are really driving UConn. But where I think UConn kind of has this is, their defense is up there. They're not letting a lot of teams score. And it's just, they're dominating every single way. They could beat you in every single way. I mean, Purdue, not to say they need Zach Edey, and he's very, very unstoppable. But without Zach Edey, Purdue would not be here. If one of the UConn starters doesn't play, they're also scoring. I mean, the opening round, they all scored double digits. The starters all scored in double digits for their win. And then in each round, they've kind of gotten production from everywhere. Now, Klingon's been their force, their rock in the middle. So I think he's the key that makes them drive. Without him, they would really be lost in a lot of places. But they've got a lot of people that do a lot of work for them. And UConn's who I've got doing it. So, I mean, I want UConn to win it all. They've who I predicted it. I can get a little bit of money if they do go all the way and get it. But the money's not the factor. It's because I genuinely think that UConn, from all the matches that I've watched, UConn's the best team on the men's side of the bracket. And now we're moving over to the women's side, and I haven't followed it as much. I don't know it as crazy, so I'm not going to get into it as much, because there also haven't been as many crazy upsets. As I mentioned in a previous episode, the only upset in the first round was 11 seed Middle Tennessee over 3 seed Louisville. And that was the third upset ever in the first round of the Women's March Madness. So big stories don't really happen. But one of the things that I'm going to mention before getting into the big stories, I was talking with my friends. So, you know, the women sticking around for 4 years, I think, is a factor that really is a good thing for the NCAA women's bracket. Now, I'm on the side of, if you're good enough to be in the pro leagues, you should be in the pro league. So people like Caitlin Clark and Paige Bookers and Cardoza, who could probably be good enough right now, should be in the league right now. But because they're not, I think it's helped grow this game of women's college basketball. I mean, you get to learn from the likes of Paige Bueckers and Caitlin Clark and Cardoza, along with head coaches. Cameron Brink as well. You've got these rookies, Juju and Hidalgo. You know, so these names sticking around have grown the game. Now, I think if these names were in the WNBA, it would help grow the WNBA a bit more. But you've got to start somewhere. The women's game is growing somewhere. The fact that they are sticking around makes it more exciting. I knew more women going into the March Madness than I did men. Now, I've watched more men's games. I'm not going to sit here and say I'm more excited to watch the women's games. The men's game to me is still more interesting just in the pace. But this isn't a debate of, is the men's game more interesting than the women's? The women's game is an interesting game to watch. If you haven't watched it, you need to. There are some amazing athletes out there in the women's NCAA brackets, in the women's NCAA league. So the big names really started showing up in the second round. The only two kind of big names to me, Cameron Brink out of Stanford and Hidalgo out of Notre Dame, are the only two that have been knocked out. Stanford got knocked out by NC State. The women's side is also going on a magical run like the men's. And the Notre Dame Hidalgo also got knocked out, but they got knocked out by a 2 seed. I think it was expected that they were going to get knocked out. But you've got some really, really big names coming up. So, I mean, on one side of the bracket, there's some amazing, amazing things going on. So LSU, coached by Kim Mulkey, stars Angel Reese and Haley Van Lith. You know, some of the biggest names in the women's game right now is going up against Iowa and Caitlin Clark tomorrow. So that's going to be a really, really, really fun one to watch. The other one going on tomorrow that I cannot wait to watch is USC with Juju Watkins going as UConn with Paige Bookers and Aaliyah Edwards. Now, I predicted South Carolina to win the whole thing, but I think UConn with Aaliyah Edwards and Paige Bookers are the best team and are going to win it all. So those are huge ones that I'm going to watch. Can South Carolina go undefeated? I mean, they've got another big match coming up, so who's to know? But ultimately, those are the ones that I'm going to watch going forward, and I do think it's going to be South Carolina versus UConn at the end of it, and UConn's going to win it all because I think Paige Bookers is actually the best player in college basketball. Women's college basketball. I know that Caitlin Clark has taken the name by storm, and I had a huge piece on her, and I predicted her to go number one, but Paige Bookers is a more complete player. She got injured. If it wasn't for her injury, she would be the name blowing up like Caitlin Clark. I think Caitlin Clark hitting the deep logo threes like Steph Curry is what helps her name. But Paige Bookers, remember the name, guys. She is and will be a huge name. I mean, it's super exciting to see where this women's game is going. You're going to have Sabrina Ionescu, Caitlin Clark, Aaliyah Boston, Aaliyah Edwards, Paige Bookers all in the league. These are all names that are blowing up and coming in, and it's growing the women's game. So the women's March Madness is a super exciting one. Again, the big matchups are tomorrow, which is April Fool's Day. Don't get fooled by anybody. If you're listening to this, I'm recording this on Sunday. None of this was a fool, by the way. So there you have it. That's kind of my take on March Madness. Now, yes, you know, I'm no absolute expert on what I do here, but it's fun recording the things that I do. I mean, my basketball knowledge. I've hit a game winner to win the NBA Finals before. I mean, I've never played in the NBA, but mentally, you know, I've seen it happen. A lot of people have told me I should be in the NBA, so my basketball knowledge, it means a lot. You've got to take it, and that's my March Madness takes. I've got UConn sweeping on both sides. This is the first time I've actually thought about it. UConn men, UConn women, they're going to sweep March Madness. You heard it first on Roped In. Well, maybe you didn't, but you heard it on Roped In. And there is another episode of Roped In. In the very beginning of this episode, I said it was episode 9. I don't know what the heck I was talking about. Everybody, this is episode 7. You've probably been following track. If you haven't been following track, you're going to see it in the tag. I said episode 9. I'm sorry. I meant episode 7. One of the things that I think is going to be really fun that I want to add in is a blooper section at the end of my episodes. Just to have a little bit of fun with it and show kind of people out there. Mistakes kind of happen. I'm having fun with it as I'm going along. It's going to be like that Sports Center with Jay and Dan, you blew it section. So there you have it. Again, as I'm recording this, NC State has a 9-point lead. I'd love to see this story go. I hate the University of Duke. I think my bracket is already destroyed, so who gives a crap? And I want these NCAA State. I want DJ Burns. They're going to go on a magical run. Thank you very much for listening. Again, we learned a little bit about Jacob Wasserman. I taught you about hurling, and then I gave you the recap on March Madness. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Again, I'll probably be touching a little bit on March Madness because the finals are going to be next Monday, April 8th. But thank you very much for listening. I hope you are all having a great Easter Sunday. If you're listening to the words this after, I hope you had a great Easter weekend. And as always, Hakuna Matata.